If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
There were 408 mass shootings last year in the United States, and in the workplace, homicides have consistently been one of the leading causes of occupational fatalities here in this country, and that's a Bureau of Labor Statistics stat. Workplace assaults result in 54,000 injuries per year, and of course, the deadliest are where there's an active shooter situation. And well, let's talk a little bit about how these things can be prevented, and if you are in the workplace and there's an active shooter situation, what is it that you should do? Brandon Grodzki is here with us today in studio to talk about these issues. He is the founder and CEO of BNT Security Solutions. He helps businesses, schools, organizations strengthen their security by doing threat assessments and workplace violence prevention, active shooter preparedness, and real-world training. Thank you so much for coming in studio. And welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Karen.
So you are a retired U.S. Army professional, and you have some anti-terrorism, physical security, and operational security experience. What got you into wanting to do this for mass shootings, to prevent them and to assess the risk of these types of things happening?
So when I was in the Army, we actually had a known threat around the same time as the Chattanooga Armory attack down in Tennessee. So we had a threat to our organization in Whitewater, Wisconsin, and I got tasked with kind of redeveloping our active shooter policy because it was very dated. So it had just been something that was really glossed over organizationally for a long time. Like, yeah, we'll talk about active shooter, but no one really thinks it's going to happen. So it was really glazed over, and we kind of identified we had an issue in our community that was making threats to our organization and leaving bullets actually at our doorstep. So we completely rewrote the policy, rewrote how we would actually go about training our soldiers to protect them and prepare them for if a situation like that kind of manifested, and we fell really hard on the University of Texas methodology, so the run, hide, fight, and Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, all fell into that. That's where all the case studies came from, and when we did that, I took all this knowledge with me, and when I retired from the Army, I figured I might as well do something with it.
Well, and everybody needs it now. I mean, it's not, you know, it's just a matter of when in a lot of cases here, and I hate to say that, but it's the truth, and even I think WGN requires us to have active shooter training. You know, we do our little videos and all of that and what to do in the event of a shooter, and I think that's, you know, it's good. It puts you in the mindset of keeping yourself safe, but it also probably helps them with their insurance premiums. Right, because it probably, if you CYA by having those kinds of videos and required training, that means they're doing what they can to help and prevent.
Absolutely. When you're starting to look at mitigating risk for the organization or a company or school, anything, if you just forego training and don't do anything to help prepare your employees, you're opening yourself up to a world of hurt with if something were to happen, the lawsuits that'll come in, you won't have any way to defend yourself. By actually showing that you do train, you have to document it. So you have training programs in place, you document those. If you have policies in place, you have to document that. If there's any type of violent situation that happens in the workplace, be it bullying, anything that can kind of push someone into that extreme violence situation, having investigations documented and showing that you're actually trying to improve really does help protect you in the long run.
And just from a legal standpoint, I'm going to weigh in with my legal knowledge. And, you know, when there's a lawsuit for negligence, and that's what it would probably be against an employer, the question is, was that foreseeable? And did you take steps to prevent it? And so now we know that these types of things are foreseeable. I mean, maybe 30 years ago, it wasn't foreseeable that there'd be a school shooting or a workplace shooting. But now that's a reality. And so if the employer, as you said, doesn't deal with it, that is going to impact, you know, their ability to defend these cases long run. And again, I'm not saying that's the only reason that companies do that, but They do it to protect their employees and themselves, of course. But again, money sometimes talks louder than these things.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, when you start looking at training and everything, like you said, in the past 20, 30 years ago, you didn't really see active shooter situations happen very often. Like, I remember coming home from school and watching Columbine, and training's changed so much since then, even on the law enforcement response side, right? When Columbine happened, they set up a perimeter. They waited for a SWAT team. They didn't make entry into the school. They ran students through a parking lot that had pipe bombs in it because they had never really dealt with something like this. Now the response is significantly different. If an active shooter situation happens and one officer shows up, they're making entry into that facility trying to get to that threat and neutralize that threat immediately.
Let's talk before we take a break. What is the first thing you do? And let's focus this on workplace shootings. You go into a workplace, they ask you to assess what the risks are. What is it that you do physically to assess what the risks are and what needs to be done?
So the first thing that I do, I actually show up and kind of sit in the parking lot and observe who's going in and out, and how they're entering and exiting their facility to see if I can make entry without a security badge, without permission, without anything. My goal is to get into their facility and then just kind of show up into a meeting and be like, hi, I'm here. I was able to piggyback behind somebody or follow someone in. I was able to knock on a door and someone just let me in and I walked by. You'll find open bay doors in manufacturing facilities and shipping facilities and unlocked doors. I was just at a company in North Carolina and I went the night before to do my nighttime assessment to see how their lighting and cameras were, and found a gate that was open to the back of their building and was able to complete my whole assessment because they had a bay door open on a Sunday evening. I was able to walk through their whole building without anyone knowing I was there.
Wow. I guess that proves that they need your help. We're talking about the issue of active shooters in the workplace and at schools. Brandon, we were talking a little bit about what you do to assess. You were talking about that you kind of look out, you stand outside, you try to get into the company to see if you can breach their security or lack thereof. And what other things are you assessing when you go to their facility? What things are you looking at, if you could bullet point for us?
Yeah, so some of the main things that I look at right away, I try to look at night at lighting. A well-lit area makes it a lot harder for someone that doesn't belong there to kind of sneak up on it. I'm looking for fencing, access control. Access control is one of the best preventative measures you can have. Badged access, not unlocking doors, making sure the right people are supposed to be in there. You can turn badges off when you terminate an employee, an employee leaves on their own or retires, or if they're suspended for whatever reason and not supposed to be on the property. So suspending badges, turning off badges, it's a very, very easy, actually really low-cost security measure that's kind of overlooked a lot now. More and more places have it, but there's still a lot that do not, especially in manufacturing and supply warehouses. I also look for cameras. I go see what type of surveillance systems they have, if they have license plate readers, if they have facial recognition cameras, or just low-definition cameras that give an idea that something happened, but you can't really see who it is, what it was. You really want to kind of have a layered setup. So at least in your parking lot, one license plate reader that can help identify what vehicle is in and vehicles that came and went. And at main entries, at the minimum, cameras that are high definition enough to recognize a face so that you can see who comes in and out of your facility. Now, as laws are changing in multiple places, there's panic buttons that you're looking for in places. When I go out to New York next year, it's going to be required any employer with so many employees has to have a panic button in their facility. And I know you sent me a question, actually, about the ELISA law that's kind of coming in.
Yeah, so I just read about that. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about it and what you think, if it's going to do anything to help any of these situations?
So, yeah, ELISA's law, it's right now, as it is, it's kind of a feel-good law. It doesn't really force positive change, it recommends positive change.
It recommends that there be what exactly?
A mobile panic button. So teachers would have, in schools, teachers would have mobile panic buttons on them that contact law enforcement directly if they need to. So there's multiple states that have passed it. Some have teeth to it. Others don't. So some absolutely require it. You have to have that panic button. There's no options. Other states, it's a recommendation, and it's actually up at the federal level also, where they're looking at making it actually federal law. So if that becomes the case, then it will be a requirement. It won't be a recommendation.
Interesting. We have a texter from the 708 area code who said having a sign in the front door that says this is a gun-free zone, is that just an advertisement to, as he said or she said, nefarious individuals that it's a soft target?
Absolutely. You know, I understand the concept of the gun-free zone, putting it on banks and things like that. Totally understand why you would have something like that. But at the same time, in those situations, yeah, you are advertising that you're a soft target. We know some states are now allowing specific teachers or employers to carry firearms to protect their students or their employees. They have to go through a significant amount of training. They have to qualify at ranges and make sure that they're able to actually employ a firearm safely, effectively, and in the right situation.
Just coming from your background, do you think that's a good thing? Because I just hear about teachers having guns, and I just, for some reason, that just rubs me the wrong way. But what, you're closer to this issue. What do you think? Do you think this is a good thing?
It can go both ways. So I think forcing someone to use carry is absolutely the wrong answer. When we had that issue in Wisconsin, and when the Chattanooga shootings attack happened, where the gentleman ran the gate at the National Guard Armory, and then you had the Fort Hood shooting, we actually armed soldiers in facilities, which is not, you would assume, like, hey, a military facility, everybody has weapons all the time. It's very rare to have a weapon unless you're on a range. So we actually armed soldiers with 9mm. You were not allowed to carry your own weapon. Some people did, but it was not authorized. If you would have used your own weapon, you would have gotten in trouble. And that actually falls back to Chattanooga. The individual that ended the threat happened to have his own weapon on him and was punished for it, even though it stopped a shooting and it was a horrible situation.
Let's talk a little bit about, in a workplace situation, who might be an active shooter. It's not just one subgroup of people here.
No. So active shooters statistically are more than likely a current or former employee. So they're generally disgruntled for something, be it disciplinary actions, really anything. They could have been terminated for something. It may be something going on at home that boils over and someone says something. Bullying. You can look at the Molson Coors shooting up in Wisconsin, or the Roundy's, the Kroger warehouse shooting. It was extreme bullying situations that really pushed somebody over the edge, and they went in with a plan and a target. Right now is a great time to talk about Henry Pratt in Aurora, Illinois. 2019, an employee that was terminated came back immediately and shot five people, walked right into the human resources office, shot an intern on their first day interning for human resources, the human resources manager, the plant manager. They were looking for a forklift operator who had reported them for something. And this individual in the past had made comments saying, if I am fired, I'm going to kill every person in this building. And everyone kind of blew it off. They're like, no, he talks like that. Don't worry about it. So kind of that, you have to fall back to that old adage, like if you see something or hear something, say something.
And it goes with school shootings, too. And I think people are maybe a little bit more aware of that situation than in a workplace, because people are always bad-mouthing the boss or saying something. But I guess when if you're in a workplace, right, yep. You're at Pratt or wherever you are, what when do you take it seriously? What are the keys to taking something seriously that's not just just trash talk for the sake of entertainment?
So at the end of the day, anyone that makes any comment about committing an act of violence, take it seriously immediately. Even if they're saying it in a joking manner, that doesn't necessarily mean it's joking. So that's something that needs to be reported immediately, taken up the chain of command or law enforcement involvement immediately. Any type of overt or clear threat of violence. But when you start looking at those warning signs, there's a handful of them that are out there. I mean, you'll have people that will make those threats. They'll do it online. They'll do it in person. They'll say things that they shouldn't be saying. But there's a lot of things that kind of lead to that. So you'll have people with physical or behavioral changes that, you know, that happy-go-lucky person, that's always in a good mood, whatever the case may be, changes suddenly. And I mean, there's multiple things you look at with that, right? Like, that's a huge suicide warning sign, but it's also a homicide warning sign. So it's not just that self-harm. It can be actually little signs that they're going to come back and do something. There's the signs someone could have significant financial stress. They could have domestic issues at home. A lot of things. Bullying can push someone to this. And in the past, when you left work with a bully, it didn't follow you home. But right. Now with social media, cell phones, you're never disconnected. It can follow you. People can text you. They can follow you on social media. They can attack you. They can do whatever they want, and it doesn't ever stop. So that's what kind of leads to those people kind of getting to that breaking point.
If you do you ever do any assessment of how the hiring process works? I mean, I obviously once something starts, what you're talking about might be red flags here, but is there some idea that hiring the wrong people in the very first place could lead to something like this?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when you check the box on an application saying, no, you can't talk to my former employer, you really can't, right? Like, you're saying, no, I don't want you to talk to these people, or this is a professional reference. So when I call for a professional reference, it's, hey, did this person work here? Yes or no. Were these the dates? Yes or no. And would you hire them back? Yes or no. That's really all you can ask. But if they ever put a former employer as a personal reference, you can ask whatever you want. So that's kind of the hope. Running background checks, even cursory background checks. I'm based in Wisconsin, so we have a system, CCAP. So I can go look at someone's court record to see if they've had anything at the county level, at the circuit level in Wisconsin.
So that's what you're looking for.
Yeah, if they have any domestic violence or battery or assault charges or anything like that, really consider what you're actually bringing in. Or ask them about it, you know, in an interview process. But that may set them off on a way that you're not prepared to deal with.
And what about mental illness? Because you certainly can't ask someone about their mental health, because that would, you know, potentially, yep, you know, be a discriminatory thing if you don't hire them and lead to lawsuits. But clearly, if somebody has had suicidal thoughts and suicidal actions and all of these types of things, I mean, how do you get to that?
That's not, you really can't unless they disclose something like that. I mean, that kind of falls into the HIPAA laws and everything like that.
Right.
Once you start looking at medical, if they say they have a disability or they have this, you can't really ask about it.
Yeah.
So there's really no good way to go about that. The only thing I would say is try to run some type of cursory background check. I mean, it's not cheap to run background checks, but at the end of the day, if you know what you're looking at, or you have an idea that this person was terminated for violent ideologies or, you know, whatever the case was in the past, well, at least you know that's not someone you want to bring on your team.
Exactly. We're talking to Brandon Grotsky. He is the founder and CEO of BNT Security Solutions. Where would people contact you, or companies who might want your service to do risk assessment and to try to help prevent these types of things?
Yeah, they can email me at bgrodsky, G-R-O-D-S-K-Y, at btsecuritysolutions.com, or call my cell phone at 262-812-3943. or they can look at my website, btsecuritysolutions.com.
Brandon, if you're an employee and you have a gun and you own a gun, at what point do, and you're allowed to have a gun at the workplace, at what point do you engage with somebody in the workplace? And I know you talk about run, hide, and fight. Can you explain that concept in light of maybe having a gun?
Yeah, absolutely. So before we get to the gun part, we'll do the run, hide, fight.
Sure.
So in any type of active shooter situation, you have three options. So run, hide, fight, avoid, deny, defend, escape, lockdown, defend, right? Like those are your options. It's all the same thing, means the same thing, just different ways of presenting it and teaching it. The best option, if you are not in the immediate vicinity of a shooter, is to run, escape, get away from there. Avoid that situation the best that you can. Get as far away from it as you can and let someone know you're safe. If you are in close proximity but not in the immediate area of the shooter, but you don't feel like you can get out of the situation safely by climbing out a window, running out a door, whatever the case is, you lock down. You barricade yourself in offices. You make it extremely difficult for that individual to get in and get to you. And you don't sit in front of windows. You disperse yourself throughout a room. You stay low, turn off the lights, and make sure cell phones are all silenced so that that person maybe hits the door and moves on to the next thing if it's locked or barricaded and it slows them down. And then the final situation is the fight, the defend. So in that situation, that's where we kind of talk about the gun, or a firearm or any other weapon. You are in a life and death situation. So you are fighting to survive at that point. So if you don't have a firearm, you grab whatever you have at hand. You work as a team. If there's multiple people in there, one will try to take the weapon. One goes for an arm. One goes for a leg. One goes for a face. But you're trying to disarm or end the threat any way you can, up to and including taking that threat's life. Because at the end of the day, your life is more important than the person that's trying to kill multiple people. Your family wants to see you. They're not worried about that individual. And yeah, that's another person, but they made a conscious decision to perpetuate an act of extreme violence against multiple people. So if you do have a firearm and you're allowed to have a firearm, you engage that person when it is safe to do so for you and for others around you, right? So if you hear it, you don't shoot through a wall because you hear someone shooting, or you don't pop around a corner and just throw a couple rounds down range or at the shooter and hope that you get close. When you're in a conceal or an extreme violence situation where you're defending yourself, you're not necessarily trying to kill or end the threat. You're trying to get yourself out of that situation. So, you know,
don't be a hero. Basically, save your own life.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You're there to, your life is the most important person to you, right? And to your family. So don't be the hero. But if the situation presents itself and you do have the ability to defend yourself with a firearm, end the threat. Absolutely. But don't do it. Don't go as, don't, you're not law enforcement. You are not military. Your job is not to assault towards the target. And for some people that are prior service military or former law enforcement, that's a very, very hard reality, right?
Like, yes.
That's not what you do anymore. Your job is not to go, okay, there's a shooter right there. I have this cover that I can hide behind that stops bullets. They can't see me. That's the definition of cover, or concealment, which doesn't stop bullets, but someone can't see you. And I can use that to get closer and get closer and get closer and get a better shot. That's not your job. You're not law enforcement. You are not military.
Do you actually conduct drills, and do you recommend drills for certain workplaces?
Absolutely. So when you start looking at training, a lot of places, initial hires, right? They do run, hide, fight, or avoid, deny, defend video. It might be the Department of Homeland Security. It might be FBI. It might be the LAPD Sheriff's Department video, whatever video they use. And that's the end of it. Maybe they do it annually. Maybe they don't. But they have you sign a little thing saying, yeah, I received my active shooter training.
Sure.
And while that does help increase survivability in a situation because your mind gets there and you go, okay, yeah, I know I only have three options, run, hide, or fight. Having scenario-based training events or even just tabletops and talk-throughs is even better. And the reason I say that, you're giving option-based training. And the more training you have, the more times you go through something, the more likely you are in that high-stress situation to fall back on your training and actually do something. So just like athletes, like anything else, the more you do something, the better you get at it. And when the stress level, when your heart rate elevates, when your brain starts going, oh my gosh, this is life or death, what do? I have a flight or fight mechanism. You can kind of fight that mechanism and be like, okay, I can think through this clearly right now and actually go, okay, I have these options. I'm not in the immediate situation. I can get myself out of this. Or I'm pretty close to it. I need to lock down right now. They can't see me, but I don't have a way to leave safely right now. So let's get this locked down. Let's get some desks moved as quietly as we can. Let's block this door. Let's block these windows, turn off the lights and hide. Or, okay, no, I'm going to die if I don't do something. It's time to fight. So when you do these scenario-based trainings or even just walkthroughs, these tabletop exercises, these talks, seminar-style training where you actually bring examples and start really, really diving deep into it, it just increases that survivability rate.
I want to address this issue of drills. You know, when you and I were kids, we had the tornado drill and all of that. But, you know, now we have these active school shooter drills. How traumatic do you think they are for kids? And does, you know, the idea that it's probably not going to happen in a kid's school, but, you know, do you think it's a good thing to have these drills? And what do you think the trainers can do to make it less traumatic for the children?
In the schools, most schools are now doing lockdown drills, right? They're not necessarily called active shooter drills. They call them lockdown drills to try to kind of prevent some of that trauma that would come from saying this is because we have school shooters. Because those lockdown drills can be used for anything, right? It can be, hey, there's a person on campus that we don't know or why they're here, so we're just going to lock down, and it's a safety measure. I think as you get older, the trauma, it's easier to explain how important this is to kids. Once you get kind of that seventh, eighth grade level, getting to the later middle school, high school level, it makes sense to them. They understand. When you're with those younger children, mitigating the trauma is difficult. When we were talking before, when we did those tornado drills, it was kind of fun.
It was fun.
We're out of the classroom. We have to get in this barricade position and do this.
Well, it was something out of Wizard of Oz, right? That's the worst could happen.
So
I end up in Oz.
So now, I think even with the lockdown drills, it can be something similar to that. So when we were talking about option-based training before, when it comes to schools, they operate in a very different way with an active shooter, right? They tend to lock down. They don't go through that run, hide, fight. They do a lockdown fight type situation. And the reason being, if you have 31 9-year-olds, and your job is to protect those children. End of story. That is your job. I guess a good way of put it, wrangle 31 9-year-old and be like, okay, we have to be completely quiet. There's no yelling. There's no crying. There's no screaming. There's no drawing attention to us. And we have to get you out this first floor window, and we have to get across this parking lot, and we have to do it so fast that no one knows we did it. It's not possible. That's why they tend to lock down. Unless they're out on recess, then it's an evacuate situation, right? But if they're in classrooms, in a lunchroom, in whatever, it's a lockdown situation for them. So, but going back to that trauma concept, I think it can be kind of similar to what we did, right? It's something different. So they may not explain that it's for active shooters. Like, hey, we have to lock down. This alarm goes off and we have to lock down. And you hope that they announce that this is a drill. This is a drill over the PA. The teachers know it's a drill. They explain to the kids that it's a drill and that if a real lockdown situation happens, they're not going to hear the word drill. They're going to hear this is a real world situation. We need to lock down. be very quiet, do what you need to do, and kind of fall back on that training.
Yeah, because I've heard of situations where maybe they thought it was a drill and it wasn't real, because how could it be real? These things just don't seem real, even if you know they're going to happen or that you think about them happening. We have a texter from 608 area code who talks about disabled people in active shooter situation. And I'm a person with a disability. I want to have my own agency as to what I want to do in the case of an active shooter and not have people decide for me. What are the issues with people who are disabled at the workplace?
So that's a really hard one, right? So when I train active shooter stuff, I always tell people, your job is survive, right? So get yourself out and do what you have to do to survive. When you start looking at disabled individuals in the workplace, some of them may not be able to. They may not be ambulatory on their own, able to move on their own and walk out or run out. They might be in a wheelchair or a situation. But someone that is cognizant enough to make a decision on their own should absolutely make the decision that they think is best for them. If you're talking, say, maybe an assisted living facility for dementia or for Alzheimer's patients, that becomes a very difficult situation because you need to stay more in a lockdown type situation because you can't just open the door and let everybody run free because you may not find somebody. That becomes a big issue with someone that doesn't know where they're at. They're confused. They're scared. They saw something traumatic that they may not even realize is traumatic, and they're just on their own.
Interesting. Let's pivot and talk a little bit about the Mercy Hospital shooting. And we're seeing, I feel like we've seen a few hospital shootings.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit about what your assessment is of that shooting and what maybe the warning signs were, what could or should have been done.
So the Mercy Hospital shooting, there was a lot that led up to that. So it was a domestic issue.
Yes.
And foremost, it was a huge domestic issue, fiance, ex-fiance. What led to the actual shooting that day was the ex-fiance came to get his ring back, and she did not have it on her. And he went to the parking lot and absolutely lost his mind. He killed a pharmacy tech, his ex-fiance, and a law enforcement officer in that situation. But prior to that, there were signs with this gentleman. He tried to be a Chicago firefighter, and he was not successful. He was kicked out of the academy for abuse of females, intimidation of females. There were signs that this was not his first rodeo, so to speak. Like, he had shown these signs, symptoms, and things that he, one, thought he was bigger and better than females, and two, just... it wasn't the first domestic issue with him. So that's where you start looking at those red flag laws, right? Because people knew he had issues and that he had firearms.
And we talked about this last week on the show with the state's attorney from Lake County. And these are the red flag laws are, someone has a mental health break or a threat or whatever, and you can report to the police, and the police can come and take their weapons on a temporary basis. And they will then have rights to prove or not prove that they're okay to take their weapons back. And they are supposedly been very successful in stopping some of this violence between domestic partners. I guess I have another question on the domestic issue. There's some laws in Illinois that say that an employer can't fire you if you have a domestic violence situation going on. And those are good laws because you don't want to, punish someone for being a victim, of course.
Sure.
But on the other hand, if you are in an active dispute with a violent significant other or former significant other, does that not endanger the workplace in general? We only have a few minutes, so I'd like you to address that.
Yeah, it absolutely does. So that's a hard one to deal with because you can't terminate that employee. You can't say, don't come to work. I'm not going to pay you. You're a risk to us. But I think when you know that situation is there, you have steps that you can take to harden your facility, make it a harder target for somebody, ensuring that doors are locked.
taking a pic, making sure people know what he looks like in case they see him walking around.
Put a picture in the break room. Put it up on the entrance once someone gets in. If you see this person in the parking lot, law enforcement needs to be notified immediately. They need to come and deal with this. And teaching people not to be afraid to say something if it doesn't look right. That is the biggest issue that leads to everything, right? Like, even that person in the domestic situation, say something. Give people a heads up that something is going on so that you have the ability to actually try to put controls and measures in place to prevent it.
Quickly, we've got about a minute. You have a couple of apps that are very interesting. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what those apps do and maybe how people can access them?
Yeah, so they're actually waiting the approval at Google and Apple right now, but there's actually a family safety app that gives a large amount of recommendations for home safety, school safety, has a Run, Hide, Fight, Children's Safe video in it for school safety, public safety measures for if you're being followed, where to park, what to do in large crowds, medical emergency things. And it has panic buttons for multiple things, be it active shooter, fires, home intruders, being followed in public, things like that, that then text all of your emergency contacts that you put in it and contacts law enforcement.
That's fabulous.
Oh, yeah. It's something that I worked really hard on for a long time, and it's finally at fruition. And then the workplace one actually has all of the training that's involved, reporting mechanisms, policies on it, a panic button also that contacts law enforcement and notifies everyone in the facility that there's a situation going on. And it has all that training that's there and documentation that's necessary for it.
That sounds really just fabulous. Brandon Gratzky, thank you so much for coming in studio. It's nice to meet you and your lovely family. BNT Security Solutions, check it out on the internet. And you can always contact me at WGN at AskKarenConti.com.